Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit. This is Twig, This Week in Google, episode 482, recorded Wednesday, November 14th, 2018. Queso Morphines. This Week in Google is brought to you by Capterra. Find software solutions for your business needs. Capterra is a free website with over 600 categories of business software. Visit capterra.com/twig and get your free copy of The Big Book of Free Software. And by ExpressVPN. Protect your online activity today. For 3 extra months free with a 1-year package, go to expressvpn.com/twig. And by CashFly. Make this the last month your CDN bill gives you a headache. Join the thousands of others who trust CashFly's reliable network. And just for Twit listeners, receive up to $2,000 in credits when you switch to CashFly before January 1st. Learn more and get a complimentary quote at twit.cashfly.com. It's time for Twig, This Week in Google, the show where we cover the latest news from Facebook and Google. Stacey Higginbotham is here from Stacey on IoT. Hi, Stace.
Hello.
Hello. Leo.
Also here, Mr. Jeff Jarvis. He is, wait a minute, I have that piece of paper here somewhere.
Uh-oh.
Grab the book.
The Tao Knight, Leonard Tao, professor for journalistic innovation at Craig Newmont Graduate School of Journalism at the City University of New York, and the director of the Tao Knight Center for Entrepreneurial Journalism at the Craig Newmont Graduate School of Journalism at the City University of New York. The largest, now it really is a lower third.
I would like to see Jeff, like, take his little hands and just kind of peek up over the lower third. I think it would be adorable. See if you can make it happen,
like
Jeff.
Like Kilroy. Oh, God, you're breaking something. Something's wet going.
There it comes. There it comes. This is comes all Jeff. For the visual audience.
Here comes
Ow,
Jeff.
She's hurting my knees. Oh, shit.
Hi.
I'm joy for that.
Hi.
You need our standing Oi. Desk where you can just move it up and
yeah.
down.
Yeah. See, for me. Yeah,
or I need the Leo desk that can just move up.
Ooh.
You're welcome for that, Leo. I know you've enjoyed doing that.
Where do you want to start today?
I think Stacey has an idea.
Talk about.
Well, technically, this is This Week in Google. So if we want to start with Google, I'm cool with that.
Let's start with Google. It says it will make arbitration optional. In other words, not required for individual sexual harassment claims. Provide more info about investigations, expand training, and more. This is in response, of course, to the walkout last week of Google employees. Sundar Pichai sent this as an email to Google employees.
This is kind of like the very least they could do. Well, I would say the most would be diversifying its board further. I would say maybe putting in some, putting in some goals around hiring, maybe not goals,
yeah,
but
diversity,
maybe advanced recruitment efforts at, you know, different places, universities that it doesn't.
Does it make sense that sexual harassment is less of a problem in a workplace that is 50% women, or is that, I would bet that's true. The more women,
well, it's also
workplace,
a question of the management, Leo.
Well, that's
it
true.
Is. It's, I mean, that's, mostly that's the culture. Because you can get a lot of harassment in places with more women. It's just women have to be in charge or in management positions.
Yeah, or in the board. Yeah, that makes sense.
Because, look at schools. There's a lot of female teachers, and there's still lots of sexual harassment happening there.
That is, by the way, the reaction of the organizers of the walkout. They're happy.
Yeah, they should be proud that they accomplished the first step.
Yeah, what they showed is collective action works. When we work together, we can make a change. However, here's what they wanted more. The response ignored several of the core demands, like elevating the diversity officer and employee representation on the board. And troublingly erased those focused on racism, discrimination, and structural inequality, which is, they said, built into the class system that separates full-time employees from contract workers. This is actually going to be a larger problem for not only Google, but Silicon Valley in general. Contract workers make up more than half of Google's workforce. but receive few of the benefits associated with employment. And
it is true.
They are largely people of color, immigrants, and people from working class backgrounds.
Those are like overarching kind of labor issues. I mean, the fact that arbitration grew so much in companies, and you look at like non-compete kind of efforts that have been dismantled over the last few years in Silicon Valley, what's happening is we're seeing workers, employees start to take some of the same sort of things that happened back in the days when they started unions. So I don't know if we're ever going to get to like actual unions, but it's good to see this kind of shift back to worker rights.
Well, like, you could say there's a balance of power between employers and employees, except that there's no power at all among employees in many cases. Most states, including California, are at-will states. California is not a right-to-work state, but it's close to it. Although California law has been tilting in the direction of employees over the last few years. So the state, at least, is trying to make it a little bit more favorable to employees. I mentioned that we have a forced arbitration clause in our contracts with TWIT employees. And the reason we do that, I'm told, is that because of California state law, it's very easy for an employee to sue us with no consequences to themselves, that, basically to harass us back. Whether there's merit in the case or not. And so arbitration kind of flattens that out a little bit.
I would say the cost to bring a lawsuit and the effort to bring a lawsuit flattens that out. That's a very common argument for forced arbitration, but it also ignores that most people are not going to file those types of suits. There's a significant barrier in finding someone to pursue those types of suits.
Many lawyers will do it and do it for
contingency, but most people don't actually want to sue.
You're relying on the kindness of your employees rather than...
Well, not necessarily. I mean, usually when someone is in that situation and they're stuck in arbitration, they're unhappy and they feel wronged and aggrieved.
But I can tell you from personal experience, employees are unhappy if they're terminated for any reason.
That's not true.
Many employees.
Sorry, they are unhappy.
Are unhappy at being terminated, and some of them decide that they want to get exact revenge, whether there's merit or not in their case.
Well, why shouldn't that go through the courts? That's what the courts are for.
Because it's extremely expensive for the business at no cost for the employee.
There can be a cost.
Minor cost. Trust me, I know. Minor cost to the employee. So, if any. You know, the cost is finding a lawyer who'll do it on a contingency basis, and then you just sit back and enjoy while the employer twists in the wind. Look, I believe me, I've considered suing and employers, and I never have. And often, you're right, there's a lot of reasons not to. It's not merely trouble. You don't want to get a bad reputation in the business you work in. And most people just aren't litigious. But there are some people who are litigious, and they can cost a company a lot of money and time.
That is true.
So yeah, I've seen a case.
Unless you think arbitration is unfair.
I think arbitration tends to benefit the employer.
Really?
And it tends to hide issues, like larger cultural issues that can be a problem for like a larger class of people.
I'll grant you, if you feel like arbitration is an unfair process, forcing employees to go through arbitration is inherently unfair. I don't think it's an unfair process. I think it's often in front of a judge. It's an extrajudicial proceeding, but there are rules, and it's designed to be fair. If you say it is unfair, then you might have a case. But I'm not sure I agree with you that arbitration is a terrible thing.
I think arbitration, like any system, like the legal system we're talking about, can be abused. And if you are the company who's paying for the mediator, you are in a position of power and can either use it to extract settlements for people and not have some of your problems see the light of day. So that's the first issue. You can use it to hide continuing issues in your company. And then the second issue is that it can be unfair to employees. It's not always unfair.
Right.
But the company does pay for it. And most people who, unless it's egregious, they might not want to bite the hand that feeds them.
Is doing what Google did, which is making it not forced arbitration in the case of sexual harassment, a good step?
Yes, because sexual harassment is one of the most common ways that people have right. used arbitration in the past to hide those
it.
Problems.
Right. Okay.
Look at Fox News.
Right.
Or Fox.
Right. Okay. So yeah, that's fair. Sorry. Go ahead. Jeff, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, I wasn't saying anything.
Well, you did say something. I just was.
I forget what it was.
Yeah, I'm sorry. That's why.
Oh, I guess I was. No, I was to Stacey. Yeah, it's expensive for both sides to do suits and risky for both sides to do suits. I wonder if having some opening to do them itself has an impact on settlements, the fear that you can do the suit, right? So does that
my experience has been almost always the opening assault is a lawsuit's going to cost you $100,000. Give us 10.
Right.
And almost always a company faced with that will do the... It's the same thing as patent trolls.
Patent, right.
Almost always a company faced with that will say, okay, here's 10. And employees know this, and these lawyers know this, and they push very strongly to get you to settle because they don't want to go to court either. They don't want to waste time. They just want to write a bunch of letters and hope that you will say, well, it's cheaper just to give you 10 bucks to shut up or whatever it is, right? And so...
Yeah. So you wonder what the middle ground is. It's really hard to find.
Yeah, I don't. What do they do in Canada? I'm sure it's better.
they just all apologize all the time. That's fine.
See,
company says I'm sorry. Whatever it is, I'm sorry.
There's some got to be some middle ground because I understand that there's very frequently there's oh it's trial lawyers and we should get them because they're just making you know. But I also think the ability to sue is kind of critical. Suing has taken on such a pejorative meaning. It merely says going to the court to get an opinion, a fair opinion on the situation, you know, some sort of judgment and settlement on the situation. So it's actually I don't think suing is a bad thing, but it has gotten very expensive and it can be very expensive to defend a suit. And there are plenty of frivolous lawsuits out there floating around.
Maybe you could do something where the person filing the complaint gets to hire and find the mediator to listen to the arbitration.
Okay. I think one thing that would be very handy, but it is not the case in these kinds of employment suits, is the ability to countersue for damages or legal fees. So if you win, I think this is what they do in Canada. If you file suit and lose, you have to pay the defendant, the defendant's legal fees. It's like, well, your suit better have merit, otherwise it's not going to be without consequence that you file suit. That's a good way to do it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is not something we're probably going to solve today, yeah. Although it'd be awesome if we did. But I think you did a good job articulating the other side. And I mm-hmm. think, I mean, that's a really important thing to think about.
Nobody's figuring out. I don't want to imply that we're getting lawsuits out the door.
No, but I mean, as a business, it is a legitimate.
It's something you have to think about. I don't have to think about it, fortunately.
I've seen cases where someone with a grudge and with a problem uses the courts to go after, to harass
yeah.
someone they don't like at length.
We know, we all know litigious people.
Yeah.
I feel like I don't. I'm okay with that.
Oh, you do?
Oh, stay that way.
You do. His name is Peter Thiel.
Oh, well, okay, yeah.
And you argued vociferously that going after Gawker was intended to shut them down.
Yes. Yeah. All right.
There's two sides, and it's a difficult yeah. one. And we really, I think we do have a little bit of a problem in this country with lawsuits. And yet, at the same time, I think the right to sue is a very, very important part of yeah. Our system.
Well, and we don't have a lot of worker protections. I mean, if we're just thinking about employees, right? We don't have, there's not even a lot of consumer protections yet, you know, even in like the software we buy and devices we have. Right. Those are all forced arbitration. So you're kind of like.
I love Google CEO Ruth Porats.
CFO.
CFO, Chief Financial Officer, Ruth Porats. Question. Why can't we solve this? We should do better.
Well, sure. The full line is if we can make a car that drives itself, why can't we do better? It occurs to me that if we can make a car drive itself is the new if we can go to the moon.
It is, isn't it?
But we haven't made a car drive itself, at least not properly yet.
No. In fact, that's a very good point as well. Although Google's Waymo division has, the CEO said, we are about ready to launch a service this fall or whatever. This is fall. It can't be this fall. Soon. Starting where they're already putting Waymos, in the next few months, you'll be getting a driverless car service. Now, when they say driverless, is there no safety driver?
I meant to look that up. That's right. That was my question.
Because that's a scary thing. Wait, this is the Wall Street Journal.
Because I think so.
Waymo plans to launch paid driverless car service. This is John Krafcik talking at the WSJD Tech Conference in Laguna Beach. He says they're going to launch it soon. They're already doing it in the Phoenix area, right? But not for pay. So that's the difference, is they want to do basically a driverless Uber. They would be beating Uber, Lyft, and everybody else to the table on this one.
Yeah.
Would you get in that car?
I would.
Yeah,
I might sit in the passenger seat and be ready to dive over and
grab the wheel, the non-existent wheel.
The non-existent. There's got to be a brake pedal, right?
No.
Or a button.
Well,
there's got to be something.
These look like the Chrysler Pacificas that they bought, which I think do have steering wheels, brake pedals, and all of that. Only vestigially, because there isn't anybody in the front seat. They already do this in Phoenix. Some cars, it says, will contain backup drivers who can take control, but some cars is not all cars. And the prices will be competitive with Uber and Lyft.
So what I will say, having ridden in self-driving cars, they are slow. You can get stuck places for a while. So in some ways, I'm like, oh, that sounds great. But then you're like, if I really need to get somewhere, I would not necessarily hop into one of those.
Yeah. There would be humans in the remote operations center who could take control of the car by remote control. But that sounds worse.
Dial in
with a joystick and a trailer going.
I'd be. That doesn't bother me. I mean, having remote control of a car is fine.
Car drone.
Yeah, I'm fine with that, because then I could be like, hey, this car cannot turn left. Could you please help it out here?
Just let me out now.
I've got ice cream melting in the car. Open here. The Let's go.
Yeah, that's the complaint. Remember, we talked about this. That was a complaint from some of the residents of Phoenix, is that it's not so much that they're driving erratically, that they're driving way over cautiously, these self-driving cars. And so you get stuck behind them because they can't. It's like a you know, when you're driving behind somebody learning to drive and they just can't make that left turn.
My daughter, I don't want to humiliate her, but she doesn't watch the show. She believes in the speed limit.
Oh, that drives people crazy. I drive the speed limit.
Does she drive in the left lane?
No, she doesn't do that. Okay. No, but she drives.
She's following the law,
limit.
Jeff.
She is following the law, but I just imagine I get scared because of the people who are going to be going crazy around her.
Tell her it's okay to drive 7 miles over the speed limit.
That's what I try to
say. Come to Austin. You know what? In Austin, everyone drives the speed limit or below, and they drive in the left-hand lane. These people are terrible.
It sounds like you're in Florida.
So just tell her to come to Austin. She'll be fine.
Turn signal just blinking the whole way.
Oh, my goodness. These people.
Isn't it funny? What is the point of the speed limit if nobody drives it?
In Austin, they do.
You mean in Germany. And, man, I've been in cars in Germany with drivers. You know, I'm not driving. I get pretty freaked at how fast they can go on the Autobahn.
Yeah, there's no speed limit.
No speed limit.
Yep.
And it's freaky. One time, you remember when the volcano came to Iceland and stopped flights?
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
And so I made it. I was supposed to get a flight out of Berlin from Republika that day. The flights were all canceled out of there. There was still a flight out of Munich. There was a location scouting company in line with me. They had a friend who got the last rental car, was going to drive to Munich. The guy said, oh, this is my old friend, Jeff. Didn't know me at all, but you can take him to Munich. So these two women took me to Munich. I'm in the back seat. God bless them. and she's hauling butt, which also, God bless, because I was going to make the flight. But I'm forgetting the conversion from kilometers to miles. And I turn on Google Maps and see the speed, and I freak and just turn it off. And I made the flight. I think it was the last flight out of Europe, and I made it.
See? This is good. I had apparently two of the kids. I took a carpool with some people, and the kids that I carpooled, they told my daughter that they were afraid to ride in the car with me because I drove too quickly.
See? I thought so. As soon as somebody says, oh, I don't like it here in Austin, everybody's driving the speed limit, I start to worry.
Yeah, I'm apparently, I drive too quickly. Mm-hmm. Keeps me on my toes. Otherwise, I get bored and then I'm
not paying
attention.
That's the problem. You're too smart.
I don't think that's the problem.
No, you are. You're bored and you're trying to make things interesting. You want it to be more like a roller coaster.
There we go. I'm trying to. I'll tell the kids that when they're crying in the back. No, keeping it interesting, guys.
Don't forget, she's got a Tesla. So not only can she go fast, she can pin the kids' heads against the seat.
I can go fast at the speed of thought. Okay. So.
Oh, lordy, lordy. All right. I'm going to take a break because if I don't start doing ads now, I may never do them. But we have lots more to talk about. We're going to do some stuff. I'm looking
stuff. At. There's going to be lots of stuff.
I like this article about the woman who's helping the Google design.
I do too, yeah. Especially because I don't love the design. So we'll
Ivy
talk
Ross.
About Google's
yeah.
design.
Yeah, ah! Ivy Ross. Yeah. We will talk about other things too.
Oh, and I added this just for you, Jeff. Google's NHS kidney data. They brought it in-house, yep. And people are upset. So you
can people
you
are
can
very upset. Yep. Especially in England.
Yeah, where yeah. their data. It's their data.
It's their data. And we've got a fairly beefy change log, I believe, this week.
Yeah, I even added something to it. Yeah you got tons there.
So there's a lot to come. Our show today brought to you by Capterra. If you're in business and you're looking for software, there's a lot of good stuff out there. The best place to go, though, is Capterra.com/twig, CAPTERRA. Capterra is a directory of thousands of business programs, 600 categories, everything from project management, e-commerce, email marketing, how to, you know, if you're a vet, a dentist, office software to run a medical office, everything you'd ever want is in there, plus 600,000 plus verified user reviews from actual users of the software, people just like you, and a really great search engine that makes it very easy to find software that has the features you require. You can even create a comparison table and with links to their websites and everything else. And this is free. This is absolutely free. This is the year, it's about to be the year 2019, the year that you get your business going with Capterra. Get the best software. Right now, if you go to Capterra.com/twig, you can download. This is an additional thing that's really cool. Their big book of free software. This is a free book that'll help you find the software you need for your business. 300 different tools that are all free. And the book is free. So this is like just a great thing to have. You put it on your Kindle or your iBooks or whatever. And it's all in there. It's Capterra. And it's all free. It's Capterra's big book of free software. Just a little encouragement to get you to Capterra.com/twig. This is such a good, useful tool. Don't people call me, they Google it. That's not the best way to find software. You get a list of stuff. You don't know what's good. Capterra makes it easy. CAPTERRA.com, Capterra.com/twig. And we thank them for their support of this week in Google. So Ivy, I didn't even know about Ivy Ross until they mentioned her at the Pixel 3 announcement. But she is the vice president of design at Google. She was responsible, I think, for material design. But really her specialty, she's the Johnny Ive of Google. Her specialty is hardware. She was responsible. She was a jewelry designer, still is, and was brought in to help fix Google Glass. That one look good.
Yeah, succeeded there.
No, but that was after, this was in 2014. Glass was already out. she was kind of stuck with that one. She's the one who put the orange button on the Pixel 2, which I really like, the panda.
Oh, I did like that.
Yeah. That's a designer, right? You know, no engineers who say, you know what would be cool is you had a black and white phone with an orange button. Nobody's going to say that. But that's what she did. The Pixel 3, I think, is very good looking. The Google Home Hub, very good looking. Better. I think it's better looking than, say, Amazon's Echo Show, which everybody widely criticized.
Oh, well, that's a very low bar. It's better looking than the Dot.
It's better.
I mean, basically,
She was the one that put fabric on everything.
She's the one that came up with mint. Yeah.
The fabric is nice.
Mint color, nice. Right? The pink one that looks like a donut. Yeah. Because I think they needed somebody to give it some human scale. Otherwise, it's like the Facebook portal, which, by the way, is on its way.
Oh,
yesterday we had a meeting and Anthony said, when's the portal coming? I said, let me check. And there was no evidence that I'd purchased it. I said, I think I'm okay. I think I escaped. No, they just charged my card. God dang it. So we can review. That is an ugly thing. The Facebook portal. I mean, that's one of those things where Facebook must really be. They just, let's get this thing off our books because it's not going anywhere.
I've been seeing the ads because we've been watching some network TV.
On the NFL, they're buying some hefty, expensive ads. Yes.
I've seen ads on the Good Place.
On the Good Place. Does this look at all appealing? I mean, look at the design on this thing. It's hideous.
It's not pretty, but the advertising is very effective. I mean, it's people basically dancing around and standing on their heads. It's very cute. It's what I think of as... It's the same sort of things you see in all of the tech companies. It's cutesy people trying to be fun and mostly human with technology. Yeah. It's the exact opposite of what it looks like when you're actually playing with
technology. And it's private by design.
Except it's not.
I was reading the headline, folks, on this page.
Ah, I was like, oh, no.
No, they say that because they got a clip you can put over the camera. I suppose I can review this and then say, oh, it doesn't meet my needs and send it right back.
Yes. Or you could not review it and you could just tell people, I'm not reviewing this because this isn't something you should buy.
I was going to do that. And then I found out I'd accidentally purchased one, too.
You can still send
it. How did you accidentally purchase?
Oh, Chef, I do that all the time. I've got jewelry, gadgets.
That's your excuse, yeah.
A click of the button.
I have a knee-jerk reaction to new products from big companies that we should have them and review them. And I bought it really without thinking, gosh, really, do we need to review this? Is there anybody who is actually seriously considering this? And then once I, you know, cooler heads prevailed, I realized there's no one in the world considering to buying this, right?
Once Stacey yelled at you.
Well, even before, I mean, there's nobody saying, gosh, should I buy this? Let's see the Twit review. Nobody is doing that.
So, what do they think it's going to do uniquely versus some other products
elsewhere?
It's
so clear that they developed it and they got to ship it. That's it.
That's the only thing that's out there is that it follows you.
No, there's cameras that follow you. That's not a new technology.
Well, that live in your home like that from the big vendors? No, there's nothing like that right now that you can easily communicate with someone.
Logitech's done that for years. I'm convinced of it. There was
like for video conference.
Yeah, remember
but not in the home.
No, this was in the home. Remember the Orbit camera? It was stood on a stalk. It was a ball. It would follow you around. This isn't hard to do. The Mevo camera, which is really, you're right, not a consumer product. It's designed for Facebook live streamers, does this. It's actually easier to do now. The Orbit actually had to move. But nowadays, with a 4K sensor, you just can say, okay, I got 4K, I got wide angle, I'm covering this room, and all I have to do is zoom in on that part of it, and it'll be high enough resolution. And I'm pretty sure I don't think the camera moves.
But I also mean the back-end integration that allows you to just say who you want to talk to. It's easy like a phone. The Logitech camera, did that have like a tie-in?
No,
it
was Skype. You had to use Skype or something.
Okay. Okay, well, Skype's pretty big. Yeah. All right. Yeah. I'll give it to you.
Yeah.
I'll give it to you.
I'll give it to you. The Kinect camera on the Xbox apparently followed you. I don't remember that.
Okay, but yeah, but that's not game. For talking to people.
So you tell me. So I went to portal.facebook.com, and I actually, in order to do this, had to log in as me, which I don't do, because remember, I deactivated my Facebook account, so I had to reactivate it.
Oh, we know.
And this is what I get. Your Portal orders will show up here. Big blank white space. I thought, oh, hallelujah. I got no Portal orders. Till they charged my credit card $600-some bucks because I bought two.
What did you order?
I bought two. Well, you can't.
Why?
Okay, again, I must have been drunk. I thought, well, you have to have one on both ends. It turns out you don't. You could call somebody who has Facebook Messenger. But I just thought, well, if we're going to test this, we got to have two. We have one on both ends.
Yeah. I mean, that's true.
Right?
Yes.
Yes. Thank you. You can be my editor.
Yeah. Wait, do I get a raise with that?
No. You do not get a raise.
Oh,
I'll send you. But here's the good news.
You'll send me a portal?
You get a portal.
I'm going to decline gracefully.
You don't want that?
You know, you can't talk to me because I don't have Facebook Messenger. I don't even exist for the portal. It's like, you want to talk to who? I don't think so.
That means I can't talk to my mom either. By the way, I just saw a stat. 44% of people 18 to 25 deleted, I think we mentioned this last week, deleted their Facebook on their phone. I think it's going to get harder and harder. I think this portal is going to be, I'll only be able to call other people's family members.
Other people's family. Your high school boyfriend's grandmother.
Exactly. Precisely.
People you may want to call.
Yeah.
Really? Nana?
Nana. I'm going to call
Boss
Nana.
Nana?
Yeah. I haven't seen Nana in 45 years.
She might be dead.
Google's AI is helping the New York Times. This is actually.
This
okay,
is cool.
This is happy, right?
This is cool.
They're
going to
take, New York Times has 5 million photos. And when I say photos, I mean physical photos, right? These aren't.
So those are all in the basement of the building where I'm talking to you from right now.
What?
We are next to the New York Times in the old headquarters of the New York Herald Tribune. And the basement, the old real room. Sorry. Lights. I'm alive. Lights.
He's alive.
So I'm alive. So the old reel room was where the big, huge reels of paper were going up into the press room, right? Up onto the docks. Mm-hmm. And so the reel room is a big, gigantic, cavernous basement. And the New York Times uses that to store their photos, their old photo morgue. Now, as the story mentions, there was a leaky pipe about two and a half years ago. And that was through our very space here.
Oh, where's the
sound?
That is not the morgue.
There he is in the basement. Oh, you want to see it again? All right, so it's alive in the basement of the.
So they are prints, right?
They're not. Are they negatives?
So we had a leak. We had a leak up above me that massacred our two floors of the school, and it got down to the basement, and there was a little bit of damage. Not thankfully, not very much, but it could have just absolutely been disastrous for all that history. And so I think that's part of the reason that they hurried up digitizing more, and now use. Once it's digitized, guess what? Google Photos can do all kinds of neat things with it.
Well, but it's more than just the front. So here's the back of a photo from the New York Times archive.
Yeah.
And so this has notes. It has received December 25th, 1942, art department files, Thursday early run. And then there is, for some reason, glued to it, clips from the paper. Penn Station.
They want to show when it ran, where it ran.
Context, yeah.
So
it's published in New York Times, Long Island, February 28th, 1988. So every time it's published, they have a stamp, and it's been used many times. I mean, this is really interesting.
I used to have my photo wheel. So look at that. It's 3 15/16 by something else, right? And you'd have to get these plastic things. This is what I did with grease pens.
It's really cool.
This is before you had your media files that are up in WordPress, where you go to the media library and you're like, Google, and now you can Google for these things and find these old photos. And I mean, I remember, and I was very young. Jeff is going to be way better at this, but we had a
I'm alive.
You are alive. I remember my first journalism job. I was telling people about Google because it was new, but I didn't understand how they did. My first journalism job was in 2000.
2000. Right. At least you're in this millennium.
Yeah.
I did work in 1999 at Business Week.
When you were 12. Okay.
Yeah. But yeah, so like they brought me into the morgue, which is a physical place with all these papers. And it was like a card catalog, only like times a million.
Yeah.
And just all the all the papers. And this is where I went to research stories. And I was like,
that's amazing.
Are you kidding me? I was like, there will be no context for my stories for the first few years.
They didn't even have microfiche. It wasn't even in microfiche, was it?
Some of the publications had microfiche. Some just had morgues full of papers.
Like newspapers.
Morgues were great. They folded them in a certain way, and they were they were all basically like business-sized envelopes.
Oh, really?
All these clips in there, yeah, and they were folded up. And
so they're not the whole newspaper. It's a clipping collection.
It's clippings. Oh, yeah, no, it's clippings. And you had three or four people whose job it was every day to take multiple copies of the paper against multiple tags, right? So this story is about five politicians. It's got to be in five folders, so it's five copies of the paper cut out and then marked.
Like if you printed Google. I mean, like that is the idea, and someone physically would do that. We actually used ours as a nursing room too, which was a little awkward, but yeah. Oh, the morgue. I don't think papers have those anymore, do they?
No, they don't.
New York Times has one. Five to 7 million photos going back to the 1970s, including prints and contact sheets. And they want to digitize it all. Jeff, you got to get us in there. I would like to see what they're digitizing it with. And
oh, yeah, that'd be a good idea. Oh, yeah, we can probably do that. If you let me know when you're coming to New York, you tell the Microsoft people you're coming to New York. You don't tell me.
We're coming December 4th, 5th, and 6th.
For what?
We're going to see Harry Potter and the Cursed Child.
Oh, fun.
And Bruce Springsteen on Broadway.
Oh, wow. You got tickets.
There was a lottery.
You're a fancy man, Leo.
I'm a fancy man. It's the last week of his performances. So we had to go. And then everybody who's seen Harry Potter and the Cursed Child said this is the most amazing theatrical experience since Angels in America. It's that long as well. You go to a matinee, then you escape for dinner and a nap, and then you come back for the evening show and see the rest of it.
Wow.
So, but if I have time, maybe we could figure this out. I'd love to get together.
If you're here on the 3rd, we'll have Alan Rusbridger being interviewed by Margaret Sullivan here at the school.
Oh, wow. You do some nice stuff. At that school of journalism of yours, at that little school
Craig
of
Newmark,
yours.
Graduate School of Journalism.
You do some very nice stuff.
Thank you.
Yes, you do. Google open sources AI algorithms. Its researchers can distinguish between voices with 92% accuracy.
I don't buy this because it still doesn't know who the heck I am, but that's just me.
Well, you hope it doesn't.
Well, no, my Google Home, I've trained it. It still doesn't know who I am.
We talk a lot about face recognition, but if you think about it, Google and Apple, too, have been collecting samples of people's voices for years now as you train these devices. I presume they live somewhere, not in the basement of the Herald Tribune building, and that they can be used. And they are presumably what's part of been training all of this stuff. Google's AI research division has, according to Kyle Wiggers, writing in VentureBeat, made promising progress toward a performant model. What the hell's that mean?
Yeah, this story. So I read it thinking it was going to help me understand what was happening, but it didn't.
But it has lots of pretty pictures.
It has pretty pictures. It has some nice things. It's talking about an unsupervised learning. No, it's a supervised learning model that helps understand different strings of language together. And I don't understand how that helps identify people. So there was a lot about this story that I was like, I felt like maybe the writer didn't understand what Google was telling him.
That's
so just
probably
put that
the
in
case.
There.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to understand it, but I couldn't.
Well, this is the library, as everyone knows, for the unbounded interleaved state recurrent neural network algorithm.
Well, I understand how recurrent neural networks work. So I felt like I'd get there, but maybe I'll just look up the original paper.
It was originally proposed in a paper called Fully Supervised Speaker Diarization.
Is it on archive?
It is Cornell University Library. I don't know if you could download the full text of it. Yes, you can. In this paper, we propose a fully supervised speaker diarization approach named Unbounded Interleaved State Recurrent Neural Networks. Given extracted speaker discriminative embeddings from input utterances, in other words, your speech, each individual speaker is modeled by a parameter sharing RNN while the RNN... So, yeah, it sounds like they are distinguishing...
Academics.
This RNN input is naturally integrated with a distance-dependent Chinese restaurant process, or DDCRP, to accommodate an unknown number of speakers. I don't know. Really, should it be called the distance-dependent Chinese restaurant process?
Yeah, I don't get that. Why is that?
It's apparently the name. Our system
is what it.
That's what it. That is what it is.
I think it's like a problem set.
It's noisy in Chinese restaurants. I don't know if you've ever been there.
No, I think it's. I'm trying to think of what it is.
By the way, it is open source. We were looking at the GitHub, but the GitHub does not contain the data code or model because that's Google proprietary. So you can run a demo, but you won't have the key value to this. Which is the data from Google. Speech recognition wonk would be interesting.
I think one of the big deals was that it was going to be done on a device. So, like, it could be done at the edge, I think was one of the important things here.
Yeah, that's certainly something we would like, huh? It's written in Python, so I imagine it's not too resource demanding.
I want the paper. Give me the paper.
Cornell has it. You have to go to the GitHub, and then from the GitHub you can get to the paper. Registration for .dev begins in January. Do you want Stacy.dev?
I do not. Doesn't Google already own this?
They're going to let you to... What was the one we were talking about? Was it...
.new.
.new.
So they use that to make your life easier. This one they're using to let devs do something.
Well, you can let people know you're a dev.
Awesome.
Corbin Davenport, writing for Android Police, says many developers, including yours truly, prefer to use I/O domains for personal sites and projects because, of course, I/O is the abbreviation for, besides being Indian Ocean, input output. But now Google is working on a new ending specifically for developers.dev.
Because they want all the I/O for the hot startups. You're either .io or .ai.
Now, .app, which Google has, is now being, is also available. And, it'll be in the changelog, but I can give it to you a little early. Squoosh.app is the first use I've seen of that. And
I think Kevin owns one of those.
I think it's intended to be PWA apps, right? Progressive web apps.
Progressive web apps. Ah.
This is a progressive web app.
Squoosh. I think Kevin has smarthome.app or smarthouse.app or something.
Yeah, nice.
How do you spell squoosh?
S-Q. I'll talk about it in the changelog. S-Q-U-O-O-S-H. But you know what's funny?
They had all the other domains they could have used.
No.
Since
it's a word, autocorrect new.
Squoosh.
Squoosh.
Squoosh. Smoosh.
S-Q-U-O-O-S-H. Squoosh.
What is a squoosh?
Well, you'll find out. Stay tuned.
Is it a verb?
It is a verb.
Okay.
To squoosh something. You've been squooshed.
Does that mean to flatten it out? Like smooshing?
Squish it.
Squish it. Okay, yeah.
It could be squish.app, but maybe that was taken.
I don't even know.
Google. Okay, so we all heard that Amazon's moving to... Now, see, I read one place it was Queens and one place it was New York City.
Queens is in New York City, damn it.
But isn't it think of New York City as Manhattan.
No.
Queens is a borough outside of Manhattan.
We have five of them, fella.
Yeah, Staten Island's not New York City. The Bronx is in New York City. New York City's Manhattan.
The Bronx is probably the most of all the boroughs of New York City, I would think.
No, Manhattan's the most.
Okay, fine. Right.
Brooklyn. So those are all boroughs. In fact, I think we've now gone through all five of them. Have we left anything out? But they're all, that's all greater New York City.
No, it's New York City.
Okay,
that's
I'm just
New
checking.
York City.
You live there. I'm going to defer to you. You Jeez. Live in Austin. I don't want to hear from you.
I mean, if you talk to, I used to live in New York.
Oh,
and
you
if
did?
You talk to,
oh, all right. Okay.
And if you talk to someone who lives in New York, they'll tell you they live in New York. And then if they live in Manhattan, they won't say they live in New York. They say they live in Manhattan.
And if you live in Queens, you say, I live in Queens. You don't say, I live in New York City.
No, we see, I live in New Jersey and I say, I live in New York.
Yeah, see.
You do not live in New York. Okay, how
Everyone
many
says they
how
live
many
in New
people
York.
At this table were born in New York City? Okay, just let's get that straight. You're just a bunch of newcomers. New Jersey
you don't sound
is not
like
New
it.
York. All right. So, but I think if you live in Staten Island, you don't say I live in New York. Well, you might to somebody. Hey, I say I live in San Francisco when
it depends
I'm in Spain.
On how far away you are.
Yeah.
Well, bingo. Exactly.
Well, anyway, man, and so. Long Island City,
chicken capital of the world.
Long Island City doesn't sound like New York City. It's on an island, not in Manhattan. But that's where Amazon's going to be. HQ2 and Nova, North Virginia. Right?
A controversial move.
They're
actually
splitting it. Arlington, and this is from the Google Day One blog. Arlington National Landing in Arlington, Virginia. How many employees in each of those venues?
A lot. I forget.
How many are they adding to New York? Like 50,000? Let me see what Google says. Because they're
like
getting 50, huge tax breaks here, right?
Oh, yeah.
50,000 across the two headquarters. So I don't know how in New York it'll be.
People are having
25,000
because does this rich company need all these tax breaks? And the L subway is already a mess. And
but wait, there's more. Google the next day announced, and we're going to double our employees in New York City. So if I were you, I'd get ready for the San Franciscoization of New York.
It would never happen. New York is too resilient. I'm serious. You could bring in, they've already got finance bros. Like, they can't handle some tech bros, please.
Right, right. And what are we going to have? Are we going to have special subway, Google bus subway cars?
Yep.
No, you're on the subway with the rest of us.
Elon's going to bore holes underneath the subway for a special subway.
Right through the bedrock. I was going to say
rents,
something.
Rents will go up. That's 25,000 plus... I think Google's doubling, so that's another 7,000, 32,000 new people. Most of them will want to live in Brooklyn, so get ready, Brooklyn.
Yep.
When you have a city of 8 million people, I guess another 32,000.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, San Francisco is 7 miles by 7 miles.
Yeah, I know.
It's tiny.
It can't grow, so okay. Are people excited in Manhattan? No, it's just another company.
It's in Queens.
See,
that's where we get snobby.
Yes!
That's where we get snobby.
It's
you can't say it because you're in California. I can say it.
It's in Queens. It's not New York. It's in Long Island City. Okay. And I bet you in Arlington, people are saying it's not in Washington, D.C. It's in Arlington.
I have a friend, a startup guy, a founder, who lives in Queens now with his wife and kid. And he's renting now as he was getting ready to. He likes living there and he wanted to buy a place, but now the prices are going to go berserk.
Yeah.
He knows it.
Isn't Arlington, I'm not as familiar with this area, but Arlington is just over the Potomac from D.C. So isn't this really going to affect D.C. a little bit too, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And there's Amazon New York, and just over the East River from Midtown. So it's pretty much New York, right? So that's a is this is you are the cities all the little cities that put on the dog and pony show for Jeff Bezos, are they pissed? Well, if you're going to do New York at DC, you should have just told us.
Yeah. But I don't. There's a lot of anger that it was this bait and switch, and they're getting data.
Well, it was a bait.
I don't understand
switch.
That really.
So the bait and switch is they thought they were going for a headquarters, a second headquarters, as right. it were. And then Amazon basically cut that in half and then threw their operations facility thing in Tennessee. And as I think Dan Primack put it really well in one of his newsletter, he's like, I'm just going to call these large satellite offices because you can only have one headquarters. So I think
that's the truth.
Amazon was doing a marketing sell for massive operations, basically. And people are like, yeah, I'll buy into that. We'll call it the second headquarters. It'll sound good. But then when Amazon split it, suddenly it looked a lot less appealing. So then everyone who tried for it looks kind of stupid, right?
You know, Sugata, who has a good job is the person who finds and builds facilities for Google. In fact,
I used to know that guy.
Yeah. I've
really?
Met him. Yeah. They just bought the Spruce Goose Hangar, which is where Howard Hughes built his giant airplane that only flew once. It was the largest plane ever built, and it was built out of wood. And the hangar itself is a beautiful wooden beamed structure, and that's going to be the new Los Angeles office for Google.
Pretty amazing, huh?
Pretty sweet. This is a drawing. This is the architect's design because it's not built yet, but that is sweet.
It is beautiful.
Isn't that?
I mean, it looks just like my office, right?
Yeah. What I love is there's a building inside the building.
Yeah.
Right?
You
there's
a huge
hangar.
You gotta respect the hangar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The integrity.
It'd be a monstrosity to heat.
The hangar.
Ooh.
Yeah, look, I mean, these walls are intact. This is really a building inside a hangar. That's wild.
The actual plane is up where now?
Oregon. The Evergreen Aviation Museum.
Oh, I thought it was in the Museum of Flight. I don't know why I thought that.
It should be.
Yeah. Bring that sucker up to Seattle.
Yeah.
Spruce Goose. Which, by the way,
yes,
best museum in the world. Maybe not in the world. Okay. But it's really an awesome museum.
You haven't even moved yet, and already you're becoming a booster.
Oh, hush, hush. I don't need. I've liked that museum for almost a decade.
Anything else great about Seattle you want to tell us?
Yes. The coffee.
I'll go for that. And I think the...
it's happening to you already, Stacey. Jeez.
I have to love... You know, I'm so relentlessly positive and sincere about things. Come on. I'm going to have to find something I love and talk about it.
She's
It's barbecue. It's y'all.
Queso.
Queso.
Will you still say y'all?
Of course I will.
Okay.
What is the best word?
It is the really good word.
All right. Back to the Goog.
It's Portlandia South.
Oh.
Or North.
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 North. Messed that up. Messed up that
Well,
guy.
I thought you were talking about Austin.
Petaluma actually. Is Portlandia so like, South.
We are kind of like Portlandia
yeah, South. Yeah. That's true. Yeah, that's true. So let's talk about people are very upset about this, especially in the UK. Google bought a company called DeepMind. DeepMind is an AI company and apparently had a deal with the National Health Service in the UK and had promised, the DeepMind Health Division has promised that the data that they had from the British Health Service would be kept private, but once they were acquired by Google, all bets are off. The health app developed by DeepMind is going to be taken over by Google. It's called Streams. It was first used to send alerts in a London hospital, but you may remember the headlines. It had gathered data on 1.6 million patients without telling them. DeepMind now wants the app to become an AI assistant for nurses and doctors. One expert, according to the BBC, described the move as trust demolition. Stacey, you posted the story. I'll give you Julia Pohl's tweet. This is totally unacceptable. DeepMind repeatedly, unconditionally promised to never connect people's intimate, identifiable health data to Google. Now it is announced exactly that. This isn't transparency. It's trust demolition.
So in this, I put this on here because Jeff and I had such a different reaction to the news in the first place. Jeff, you were very like, hey, this data could be used for good. You know, who needs consent? Because the big debate was over the lack of consent. I don't know if you recall this, Jeff.
Yep.
So this is what I was worried about, is the idea that once that data is in there, you don't control where it goes. And in this case, it's going back to Google.
It's so important because you may even feel trust with the company that has the data, but it often happens that these companies get sold and the policies change, and they've got the data. You gave them the data, and they're not bound often by the promises the previous owners made to you.
Now, under GDPR, you could actually get that data
deleted,
strike the permissions from that data. So yes, but in this case, no. I'm curious how GDPR plays into this, if it does at all. And I don't know. I was trying to figure that out before the show.
Yeah, I don't know either.
But that's one of the questions. But I mean, this is the problem. And I don't know how we solve for that, because absent legislation, because companies have a vested interest in, you know, taking this and bringing this in-house. And we've seen it happen again and again. And again,
and it's not a question of Google's intentions. Like, well, no, we promise we're going to be good with your data. It's just that the promise was made this data wouldn't be connected to Google, and it has been.
Right. And Google, once it's connected, I mean, they have a fiduciary duty to make the best use of their data that benefits their shareholders, not to me as the person who maybe provided that data.
Now, according to the BBC, once this came out last year, the UK's information commissioner ruled the UK Hospital Trust, which was involved in the initial trial, had broken UK privacy law for failing to tell patients about the way their data was being used. The information commissioner told the BBC it expected that all the measures set out in its audit to remain in place after the DeepMind health moves to Google. An independent review panel set up to scrutinize DeepMind's relationship to the NHS was unlikely to continue in its current form, given the U.S. takeover of the health division. In other words, they're deciding it doesn't matter anymore because Google's an American company.
But hold on here. The DeepMind response to the BBC: patient data remains under our NHS partner's strict control, and all decisions about its use will continue to lie with them. The move to Google does not affect this. So the fact, basically what they're complaining about is now that data is next to a company with cooties, in their view. The issue here is what's the use and what's the harm, and just because it happens to be, then the issue is the terms of the use of the data. The issue isn't that, oh, it's near Google. That's why I'm not understanding this story. I'm not understanding where the break of trust is there. I don't get it.
The breach of trust is that this data wasn't supposed to go to Google, the DeepMind data. And also, it's unclear what inferences were made from that data that could then be put back under Google.
Where did Jeff? Where did you see them say, "Whoa, it's still not going to be
the BBC story"?
Okay.
Which you have under the embedded tweet.
Oh, in response, DeepMind told the BBC patient data is under our control.
Right, so yeah, the issue here is not. I mean, listen, DeepMind could have been bought by anybody. It could have been bought by Amazon. It could have been bought by anybody, right? It's not that it could have been bought by Rupert Murdoch and I'd be screaming, right? But the issue is not the ownership of the company. The issue is the terms on the data. And just because Google owns the company doesn't mean that evil has now occurred.
But they're using that data in plan to do, like, they're planning to take the information and the inferences derived from that information and put it into
okay,
other
and what's the harm
of practices.
That? And what's the harm of that?
It's unclear when you take those inferences. It's unclear how divorced those really are from individuals' data.
I got
it. Some people don't want their individual data in there at all, and that should be their right.
We're gonna have the same argument we had it before, Stacey.
Right.
But this is knowledge. This is knowledge gained from information. Okay. And that not in a modern society, you do not control and own knowledge. And if I looked at that data with my eyes or with AI, no difference. I said, "Oh, wow! People who use hippie water bottles are 10% more likely to get kidney disease." So now you're saying, "Up, oh, you can't know that, Jeff. No, 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 no. You're not going to warn people using hippie water bottles that they might be in danger here. No, no, no. Because my data was in that pool, and I don't want you to use it for that. So you can't save anybody from getting kidney disease who uses hippie water bottles." And for those of you on audio, I reach for the nearest prop.
He has a hippie water bottle.
A hippie water bottle. It's not a hippie water bottle. It's just not a plastic water bottle.
I think it'd be a little different. I understand what you're saying, Jeff. It'd be a little different if the initial breach of trust hadn't occurred. In other words, the NSH had, without permission, handed over all this data in the first place to DeepMind. And DeepMind has already been told that was illegal. And they're already being under supervision. And so there is kind of this built-in, well, we're not sure we trust you. You already breached our trust once. Although you might say it's the NHS's fault, not
right,
DeepMind's
sure.
fault.
But
and
you
I'll
could
still
also
argue
flip
with that
your
fight
argument
against NHS.
Yeah.
Right. You could also flip your argument, though. Instead of saving people from getting cancer from hippie water bottles, what if we say we're charging people who have the following characteristics 100% more for insurance? And then people might be like, well, I don't want to contribute to that. That's terrible. So
there's always that argument that this will be used in a malign way as opposed
yes,
to
Yes, I'm just way. Pointing out that Jeff, your argument was made in the most, you know, I was just flipping your argument so people
Yeah, I'm
had
still
going to
stay on my
side,
Stacey.
I know.
I'm still staying
know.
On my side of the fence.
I still believe.
I'm over here.
It's going to make a difference in the lives of millions of patients around the world. Google said that.
I do believe that this kind of data is really useful. And that's why I'm so glad that there are a lot of people who are creating like data donation, like medical data donation kind of programs where like I can say, hey, this is my information. I want to share this with the program and make the world a better place.
This is kind of the continuation of my continued complaint about Google, which is that nobody would have this complaint wouldn't be as vigorous if it weren't that Google is also using data to sell advertising. And so if it were a different company that had, you know, that wasn't trying to use data to sell advertising, it would be easier. But it's the same reason I don't like Google buying YouTube, because they do search, and so there's this potential for them favoring people who use YouTube as opposed to people who don't. And that's the kind of that's where this Google gets into this position by being so big and all encompassing, and people get nervous about them. Jeff, don't you? I mean, that's not an unreasonable thing to.
But again, Leo, but nervousness is not. I don't like big companies. I don't like American companies.
No, it's not that I don't like big companies.
That's
it's
not
that
sufficient.
I don't like a company that makes a living selling personal data to advertisers.
Give
to
me
be the
one
actual steward
harm.
Of this medical information.
Give me the actual harm and balance that with the potential benefit.
We can't just
and
say
I'm trying
we
to
can't.
Protect
I
I'm trying
grant
to protect
you that there's
the notion
benefit.
Of knowledge.
I grant you there's potential yeah. benefit. I'd be a lot more sanguine about it, though, if it weren't a company that's selling our data for advertising purposes, that's not their primary business. If it were some other company buying this, if it were
NHS
IBM buying this.
NHS has control of the use of data. NHS ain't going to allow it to be used to sell you
No, those people in hospitals, I mean, look at what's happening with Memorial Sloan Kettering and the way they sell their name to
and it's the fact that the National companies. Health Service in England gave this data without asking patients, just gave this data.
Sorry, folks, but I'm going to defend the Enlightenment. Knowledge. The fact that if you start cutting off conclusions from information. And if you let everyone who has any part in producing any bit of data, you cut off the ability of conclusions to be made from that data. You're cutting off education, science, and the friggin' enlightenment. Stop.
Yeah, but it's not that we're against that, Jeff. It's we're against Google being the sole one doing this.
Wait, no.
Google's business is selling data.
And I would also argue it is our job to think about as we bring this, as we bring connectivity and scalability to like searches and digitize everybody's records, it is incumbent upon us to think about the harms that can come from that, not just the benefits. Because if we don't, someone else will, and we will find ourselves in the way that we have found ourselves with like Facebook and Cambridge Analytica. That is exactly why Facebook is on trial right now in public opinion, not in the actual legal systems. So I'm just saying that we have to, I mean, it may sound like techno panic, which I'm very proud of you that you have not said that once, but.
Thank you for saying it for me, because it does.
I know. But we have to, Jeff. That's our job. We can't.
But we also have to balance that conversation with.
And we do. And that's why I put this on here.
Rather than going to an emotional argument, I don't like Google, I don't trust Google, which is what Leo is saying, instead then deal with the actual harm and the actual cures for that.
So the potential for harm is, the potential for harm is that this data can be traced back to individuals in ways we don't understand now. There's also the potential for harm in that data being used to disadvantage certain classes of individuals just as much as it helps them. So those are the two largest potential harms I see. There's also potential for harm if it's not secured correctly and that sort of thing. But hopefully the NHS.
There, I absolutely agree. But what I am saying is the fact that this ends up in an app used in a hospital to help diagnose sick people. I'm sorry, but I'm going to defend that. And that doesn't mean that the data that was contributed six steps back the line of an AI is at risk or is at jeopardy.
You could argue, though, that the Tuskegee experiments helped diagnose and cure sick people, but those were morally reprehensible. And you could argue that when you start looking at data and pulling data in aggregate into something, it can be used in ways that are just as morally reprehensible. And that's what we have a duty to consider.
So the problem there is, as Leo said, it's you know, who... Tuskegee or NHS, it's at that point. And there are, I'm not arguing at all there are protections needed. I'm not arguing at all that there, I mean, why do we have the systems we now have in universities and hospitals and around medicine around how experiments are done? Absolutely agreed. Those are issues.
So maybe we need like an IRB for.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Which the NHS is showing us
operates under.
Right, which we should actually have updated IRBs and understand the implications from this. And that's why we're talking about it.
What's an IRB?
Internal Review Board. Okay. So if you're doing experiments on people or human research, thank you. You may have to do it for animals.
You have to have it reviewed for impact and
so why do you think Google bought DeepMind?
Because they want unsupervised learning.
I mean, did they buy it because they wanted to save the world? Did they buy it because they're a profit-making institution that knows that data is?
You can keep both thoughts in your head at the same time.
I don't think Google wants to save the world. Google's a business. It's a profit-making enterprise.
They have a fiduciary duty to their shareholders they will maximize.
I don't think
profits.
Google does anything because they want to save the world. I think Larry and Sergey might have some. You know, projects they think will save the world. But honestly, the company...
I think organizing the world's knowledge and making it accessible is a version of saving the world.
It is a good thing.
Damn Gutenberg, all he wanted to do was make money. Jeez.
Oh.
You know, you can do both. You can do something that's good for the world, and you can make money.
That is true. But you can also find those at odds in certain situations, and when they're at odds... Do you go for profit making or do you go for saving the world? In a company, you tend to go for profit making, which might be a good time to talk about Google in China.
Oh, I thought you were going to say advertiser, ExpressVPN, and then we'll talk about Google in China.
Oh, okay, fine.
I'm going to make the money. I make the money.
Speaking of profits.
Yeah, you see what took priority there? Huh?
I'm the captain now. our show today, we'll get back to the conversation. It's always a great conversation. Jeff Jarvis from CUNY and BuzzMachine.com. And, of course, the great Stacey Higginbotham, Stacey on IoT.com. Our show today brought to you by a company that does want to protect your privacy, ExpressVPN. We talk all the time about security breaches, ISPs selling your data to the highest bidder. You are being tracked. We know you are by social media sites, marketing companies, your ISPs. They can record your browsing history. They often sell it to other corporations that want to profit for your information. You can hide yourself online with ExpressVPN. Easy-to-use apps that run seamlessly in the background of your computer, your phone, your tablet. You turn them on with one click and boom, you're privatized. It secures and anonymizes your browsing by encrypting your data and hiding your personal IP address. Suddenly, you're emerging on the internet from ExpressVPN servers. They have servers all over the world, by the way. You can surf safely on public Wi-Fi without being hacked or having your data stolen. Number one VPN service, according to TechRadar, and it comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee. The price is right, too, less than $7 a month. And, of course, no logging. Read their privacy policy. They do everything right at ExpressVPN, or we wouldn't mention them. If you don't want to hand over your online history to your internet service provider or data resellers, ExpressVPN, rock-solid privacy at blazing speed, no compromises. Protect your online activity today. Find out how you can get 3 extra months free when you buy a 1-year package at expressvpn.com/twig. expressvpn.com/twig. That's expressvpn.com/twig. We thank them for their support of This Week in Google. What did you want to talk about, Stacey? What was the China? Google and China? Mr. Page, you're muted.
Sorry.
I didn't do it. I swear I didn't do it.
I know. No one. There's no remote. No remote mute. No, I was just, it was the justification for Google and China. I was just, you know, going with our theme. But yeah, we could also talk about other things, like the change log.
Oh, it's time. Thank you for mentioning. It's time.
There's just so much.
There's so much. We better get to the Google change log.
Google change log.
The log that's so big, it even leaked out into the other parts of the show. For instance, this was a story not in the change log. Android will automatically turn on your lights when you turn off your alarm. Two new features for the Google Assistant on your Android device. So the latest version of the clock app by Google has this, the latest version of the Google search app. And if you have, of course, Google Assistant, you can program the assistant to report on your commute when you turn off the alarm, turn up the temperature. You can ask it to play a podcast when your alarm goes off, some music, lights, thermostat, coffee maker, whatever it is. All of this from submenus within the clock app. So look in the clock app and you'll see all of those. And if you have a Pixel 3 phone, you know you can set Do Not Disturb to mute incoming calls or alerts. I actually have it set by schedule. So, you know, 10 p.m. to 7 a.m., I don't want any calls. But soon you'll be able to tell your assistant, hey, you know who, silence my phone. And Do Not Disturb will be turned on. But this is not in all Pixels.
So I thought my phone was broken. And, of course, a little bit of me was looking for an excuse to buy a Pixel 3 because I really decided not to. But I thought, oh no, my phone is broken. How disturbing. Because it wouldn't ring for like 2 weeks.
Uh-huh.
And I had turned on Do Not Disturb. I don't even know how I turned it on. I finally, just as I was ready to hit the buy button, oh, crap, it's not broken.
I've actually
Do Not Disturb was on.
Experimented with leaving Do Not Disturb on 24/7.
It was kind of nice.
I do that all the time.
Because you can say, I only want people in my contacts to call, or I only want people in my favorites to call. And that's really the only calls you want to get, right?
So, my wife was not happy with me. That.
Yeah. So you need to add her to that. She can call.
Well, I'm just,
Or turn off Do Not Disturb. But I think that that's an interesting way to run. Then your phone doesn't bother you.
Yeah, I used to have mine on Do Not Disturb. Oh, no. Never mind. Ignore me. Just ignore me.
I wish I had.
I leave it on Do Not Disturb all the time.
Yeah, mine's on Do Not Disturb right now. Yeah.
Ms. Higginbotham is not available for comment.
Yes. Files by Google is being updated. The file management app for Android. Files Go came out last year, and they're now renaming it to just Files. So Files Go is now Files. They've redesigned the user interface. And there's a little celebration when you clear out files. Should I try it? I don't know if I have the newest one on here. Let's see if it's called Files instead of Files Go. Yeah, I guess I have the new one. So is this
so when
it?
You delete things?
Yeah,
you get a celebrate because Google hates to let me delete stuff. I'm always like, please, Google, I want to get rid
files.
Of this.
It's this Files. Okay. Junk files, select and free up 334. Shall I just delete? Let's just delete these all. Delete these junk files. Clear them all out. Let's see the celebration. Well, that wasn't much.
Well, that was very exciting.
Let's do more. Let's do more. Let's do more. Duplicate files.
For those
deleted.
On audio, it didn't do jack.
Didn't do nothing. Oh, there's a little guy. A little thumb came out.
That was even more. I can't stand the excitement.
Oh, it's exciting. Hey, look, this is the change log. It doesn't have to be exciting. Deleting.
It's got to be worthy of trumpets, for God's sake.
We'll now celebrate how much you save by telling you what you freed up room for. So I don't know what that means. But
ooh, I need that in my like calorie counting apps or my exercise
apps. You lost weight.
Congratulations. Now you can eat a piece of cake.
Oh, that would be good. You've just earned a piece of cake.
I think there used to be something like that out there.
Project Fi is getting smart. You're a Project Fi customer, Jeff.
Yes, I am.
Are you Stacy as well?
No.
One of the things they're doing, we just did an ExpressVPN ad, but if you're a Fi subscriber, you'll have access now to 2 million Wi-Fi hotspots that have VPN built in. And they're extending VPN now to all your connections, which is very cool. So I'm not sure how you turn that on. When you're on the go, you're likely connecting to new networks, and the security of all the networks isn't made equal. Ah, when you enable our enhanced network, all of your mobile and Wi-Fi traffic will be encrypted and securely sent through our virtual private network on every network you connect to. That's a good thing. Faster connections now. In fact, I always assumed that the way Fi worked was it went to the strongest signal, but apparently that wasn't how it worked, or it's something they're going to do that's a little bit differently, but they are now going to switch carriers based on the strength of your connection. I thought they were already doing that, but now they're going to do that. So there are some updates to Project Fi, which, by the way, will not be called Project Fi in the future. It'll just be Google Fi. No more project.
It's not a project anymore. It's a thing.
It's a thing.
Excellent thing, Fi.
It's alive. It's alive.
Actually, Chrome 71 is practically alive. It will warn you about unclear billing charges and subscription signups. It will show a warning before pages that don't provide sufficient clarity to the end user about a transaction. They've quantified best practices for making a visible and clearly explainable billing process. This is especially true on Chrome on mobile.
Huh. Well, don't people realize when they have to give their credit card information that they're buying something?
You would think, you might get this warning. The page ahead may try to charge you money. If you don't want this, go back. Wow. Wow.
You know, something like that would be really effective for, you know, privacy policies or data, like non-encrypted data notifications.
They kind of do that now, right? Where they warn you if you're on a page that's not necessarily fully encrypted.
I think Leo needs that for every page he goes to, so he doesn't buy, Facebook
portals.
Yeah. Well, your IRC is not secure, according to Chrome.
It isn't. Is there some reason you want it to be?
No, I'm just saying that they state do that, secrets. But it would be interesting if they like scanned all of the EULAs for like devices or something. And if I were going to go buy something or Googling like a Nest thermostat and it said, by the way, Nest does not follow traditional encryption practices. They do, by the way. But, you know, they gave you a basic warning in plain English about something like that.
Lots of reviews this morning of Google's new Night Sight feature. It's finally rolling out to phones. This was something Google touted when they announced the Pixel 3, but didn't make available when you first got it. I haven't received the update yet, but apparently it just does an amazing job. All the reviewers are just blown away by how good stuff looks. Yes, yes, I keep going to looking. It is taking 15 images, some of them as slow as 1/4 of a second shutter speed. Obviously, with motion, it's not going to be able to use that one if something's moving, but it can tell if you're on a tripod. It can get very low, frame rates to get very high-quality images late at night. Look at the difference there. So keep your eye
peeled. That's awesome.
Yeah. If you have a Pixel 3, it'll work best, but they are going to migrate this to the camera apps on both Pixel 2, Jeff, and Pixel. But
Yay.
Pixel 3 is the one that is smartest about this. It's got the extra juice in there, the extra processor.
So to say the dedicated processor.
Yes. Well, but remember, the Pixel 2 had that too. I guess it's just a better one. That's pretty amazing what it's doing.
It is.
Yeah. Lots of posts about this. And I think this is for Stacy. Create your smart home assistant for the holidays. I don't know, making a great meal. I don't know. This is maybe just ad copy. Setting up daily habits as a family.
Yeah, this is ad copy for Google.
Turn your living room into a... You do all this already.
I do this, and it's not even my birthday, my holidays.
Tomorrow, Stacy, the guys are coming to our house to put up the lights. I'm very excited.
Oh, congratulations. Do you have your outdoor smart things, or did you say, I can do it with the timer?
I bought that one from whatever that you mentioned.
Oh, good. iDevices?
I got six of them. So they're all over the place, and then I gather... I'll be able to, with my phone or my voice, say, turn on quadrant one.
Yes. So here's my pro tip for you and anyone else doing this. When you label your outlets, I label mine with tape because if you move, you want to remove it.
Yep.
But label it whatever you call it in your Google or Madam A app. So I have upper balcony, lower balcony, roof, snow globe, and whatever else I've got, Christmas tree. And that way you only have to add them once. And then when you take them out, next year, you just plug them in and they work.
Put them in the right spot.
Yeah. I was like, but plug them in the right spot.
Yeah. No, I got my brother label maker ready to go.
So there you go.
Yep. I know. I just don't know yet what those will be. I think. And then I also haven't yet paired them my phones, but I can go. They're Bluetooth. So I go next to it and it'll pair. Go next to it. And so I can name them at that time and do the label maker and all that. And then I'll know what those like. We have a giant Santa.
Merry Christmas
for the garage.
Test it. I forgot that they're Bluetooth because they work with HomeKit.
Right.
Yeah. So test it first and make sure the range isn't going to be a problem.
Like they're too close to each other?
No, they're too far away to be remote controlled.
Oh.
I don't know how big your yard is.
That would be annoying if I had to go around the house to turn them on.
Yes, would defeat the entire purpose.
But if they're not Wi-Fi too, they're just Bluetooth?
I guess so. I don't know.
That's a bummer.
I have Z-Wave ones, but I don't recommend those to normal people because nobody wants to buy a hub, which I totally get.
It says I can do Siri, Echo, or Google Assistant, but I guess it's via Bluetooth.
Then they're Wi-Fi.
Well, I don't know.
Hold on. It's Wi-Fi.
It says Wi-Fi. Good. So I think it's Bluetooth when you pair, right? You pair.
Oh, okay.
But then you give it a name. You configure it.
Yes.
You
Wi-Fi
put it on your
outdoor
Wi-Fi.
Smart plug.
Oh, thank God.
I was like,
I bought $300 of them, Stacy, on your recommendation. I was about to be very disappointed.
Well, now I was like, wait, I tried these like a year and a half ago. So they worked a year and a half ago at my house. But I'm like, when you said Bluetooth, I'm like, wait, what?
I'm going to say, hey, Echo, light up the garage. The garage is going to light up. Light up the portico.
What you're going to do is you're going to group all of them.
Yes,
so then you're going to create a group.
Yeah.
And then.
Yeah. Turn on lights.
Particularly twiggish with
Christmas.
With your display.
It's Twitmas. I don't know why we're doing this. We've never decorated the house before, but I got the plans out for the house so I could figure out how much roof line I had, 413 feet. And then I doubled it just in case. And then Lisa, then she said, and I want it to go up the side of the thing and down the thing and around the bushes and over the river and through the woods. And so we got more, and we got big balls. We got stars. We got a sign. We got a Santa that goes, ho, ho, ho. And then can I have all of that tied to one action where I say, turn on the celebration?
If they all talk to Echo, all the devices can talk to Echo, then yes.
They're all on those switches.
Yes. So then all of those switches, you'll label them. You'll group each one into a room or into a, I would group it into a room. And if you group it into a room and the room's called like Christmas or Twitmas, then you just say turn on Twitmas.
Turn on Twitmas. Yeah.
Yeah. You might want to test Twitmas to make sure she understands that.
What are you saying? What are you saying here?
I'm just offering. I have some poorly named things that I'm like, I need to read. We have something called the Nano Leafs, and I call it Nano Art, and she hates it. She keeps giving me definitions for fart. I swear to God. I'm like, please. So I need to change.
And Google Chrome Labs has released its open source, browser-based image optimization tool, Squoosh.
Took me a minute to figure it out, but it's kind of fun.
Supports a wide variety of formats. It can show you the original, and so the key to go to install this is, and this is kind of new too, it's you go to a website, Squoosh app. And if you go on a mobile device, depends on the device. If you go on a mobile device, you can actually put this on your screen as if it were an app. And the idea is you drag and drop or select an image.
You can take a photo of you and look at the quality.
And it'll squish it. And then once it squishes it, it'll show you.
So over on the right, Leo, go to quality and move that far to the left.
Oh, you can degrade it. Let's degrade the quality.
Wait a minute till it does it.
Yeah.
Now you'll see degraded quality, not so much.
Well, let's turn it all the way down. Zero quality, Squoosh. It's 94% smaller. But see, this is why Squoosh is so good. Yes, it degraded, I guess.
Well, I put a picture up. Can you see the degrade? Yeah, I can see it.
Look at the whiskers. It's more blocky. But still, that's pretty good, right?
It's pretty good. So it demonstrates
you can choose different compression. You could have WebP, browser ping. You can, this is a good tool to learn what's going to do what. I'm going to do browser ping, resize, reduce palette. Oh, it's big. Browser ping is big. Moe's JPEG was really small. How about browser JPEG? Now I can really, let's get it down there. 317K. That's pretty good. So, and then you could save the image out. So this is a really handy way to have an app on your mobile. This is completely cross-platform, or on your desktop to do this, which is cool. You like? This is squoosh.app. Squoosh.app. It'll also do this is an SVG. I could do OptiPing. Ooh, it's bigger.
So then I also went into the resize, and I resized it down. I'm trying to understand why the quality went down so much. I don't get it.
Well, if you make it smaller, you can't. If I make a tiny little icon, 20x28.
Right. So I made. All right. Okay. So I made it into a very small image.
Yeah. And if it's a vector image, that's kind of
basically blown up.
This can also teach you a little. Ooh. This can teach you a little bit about images and image formats and quality and stuff. This is cool.
So is this mainly just a demo of .app?
I would say it's a demo of progressive web apps because I saved it out as a icon onto my iPhone and Android phone. And it works on both. It's pretty cool. Squoosh. And that, I think, what else, Carsten? You put a lot of things in here. I'm not going to do them all because there's... Which one do you like? Any of them? She hates them all.
In the changelog?
Yeah, well, we put a lot in there just to make sure that we covered everything, but I think a lot of this we don't have to.
I think you got it, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you don't care about emojis on the Gboard, do you?
No.
May we GIF you a suggestion?
Nope, you got it. You got it. Cue the music, Carson.
Cue the music. Cue it before it's too late. You, gosh, we came close to doing emojis.
Well, dodged a bullet right there.
Hey, we mentioned that the Times is digitizing, but, you know, I have to give kudos to the Art Institute of Chicago. They have put a big chunk of their collection online at their website, 50,000 images, and high res. I mean, you can see brush strokes.
Ooh, so, that's what we should have squooshed.
We should have squooshed those, huh? This is really, really cool. So this is part of a new website for the Art Institute of Chicago. But if you like images, this is a good article, actually, at their website. It's artic.edu, Art Institute of Chicago. But if you want to, and one of the things they're doing is highlighting lesser known. Everybody knows about American Gothic, right? But they're also highlighting some lesser known. Oh, actually, I clicked the wrong one. I don't care about American Gothic. Let's get The Bedroom by Vincent van Gogh, because you know, every time I see a Van Gogh, I want to zoom in and really see it and really kind of get
out those brush strokes.
Check out those brush strokes, right?
So this is really interesting. They talk about it for, you know, just putting as your desktop, but and this is a trend in the high end, like Cydia home electronic space, is televisions that act as picture screens or devices like the Mural. And so having access to this, because a lot of those have proprietary art that you subscribe to, but if you could just point your, you know, frame device, your digital frame device at, you know, a rotating image from the Chicago Museum of Art, that's actually really kind of a neat thing to have in your house.
Do you think some museums are loath to do this because they don't want people to steal their imagery, right?
Hey. You know, I think most museums are there for education.
Good.
And there is something very different when you go in person to see art than just seeing a reproduction of it. And this is still a reproduction of it. So I don't think this... But it is nice if you've
not everybody can get to Chicago and really see this. And I love seeing, you know, Monet's brush strokes. I mean, I just love this stuff. And when I go to a museum, it's one of the things I immediately do is walk as close to the picture as they'll, or sculpture as they'll let me. and really kind of like scope it out and try to imagine standing there next to Toulouse-Lautrec as he paints it. I mean, that's part of the fun of it. And you can kind of almost do that with these. You really can zoom in. It's really neat. I wish you could zoom in a little bit more. Obviously, they used probably a pretty high quality camera, but I would love to go in two or three times more than this, even. But still, very nice. 50,000 images, artic.edu, Art Institute of Chicago. I'm a little nervous. I don't know whether I should be nervous about this. Pandora, you know, got started. Tim Westergren started Pandora because he did the Music Genome Project, in which he tried to categorize music by the, you know, not just by the instruments in it, but by the feel, the style. And that's how Pandora got started with its music recommendation engine. If you like this song, you'll probably like this because they're in the same music genome. Now they want to do the same thing with podcasts.
Oh, hey. I'm one of those. The Internet of Things podcast is one of those.
Congratulations.
Right. I'm part of the beta group.
Oh, nice. So what genome are you in?
The awesome genome.
Do you think we're in the same genome?
I think so. We're tech news shows.
So it's in beta today. Select Pandora users on iOS and Android devices. It'll expand to wider public in time.
You should, if you sign up for the beta, you should expect to see it sometime in December.
Oh, you know all about this.
Again,
so I thought that the genome wasn't as important as they thought it was, and that it was really kind of a different.
Well, anybody who's listened to a Pandora channel for any length of time might think that the genome is not exactly perfect. For some reason, I always get a Beatles song, no matter what I'm listening to.
Then it's very good. They know you well. So Spotify and Netflix are the next generation of recommendation engines, and they use a different criteria. Yeah. So I think what you may be referring to, Jeff, is just the idea that it's basically an older way of suggesting music.
According to Pandora, the Podcast Genome Project can evaluate content over 1,500 attributes, MPAA ratings, production style, content type, host
profile.
Oh, they
did ask about that. Yes, they did. They asked what type of, like, we put a, that we were tech news, that we were news focused. We were focused on tech. We had improv / witty banter, which may be giving Kevin and I too much credit, but it's the style, and other styles include like scripted interviews, storytelling. We are not those. So there were about 10 categories.
And then it will use listener signals like thumbs, skips, replays to continue to refine their recommendations. This will be interesting, I think.
I'll let you know if I start seeing a rush of new listeners.
Anything that improves discovery is good.
Yeah, I mean.
Yeah.
Did you see the article? We talked about this on Twitter a little bit, but I wanted you, your thoughts as well. In the New York Times about Yuval Noah Harari. He wrote that a couple of really good books, I thought, Sapiens, Homo Deus, and he's got a new one about lessons that the tech industry should learn. But basically, according to the Times, he's the principal doomsayer of Silicon Valley. He says that by creating powerful influence machines to control billions of minds, the big tech companies are destroying the idea of a sovereign individual with free will. He believes Silicon Valley is creating a tiny ruling class above a teeming, furious, useless class, as he calls it. And he says in previous eras, autocrats needed the peasants because they grew all the food, but Silicon Valley doesn't really need the useless class. So they're much less likely to keep them around.
One might argue that their entire business model is based on monetizing the useless class.
I would say they need us to buy their crap. But, yeah, he's embraced apparently by everybody from Google X to Reed Hastings of Netflix. And they, when he came out to Silicon Valley, he was invited to dinner parties and everybody.
My husband's read all of his books. I started books. Sapiens, but I was kind of like, oh.
It's one of those you have to like.
It's a slog.
Oh, I didn't think so. Really?
I thought it was a slog.
You have to like books like Freakonomics and the Malcolm Gladwell books. They're kind of a little pat.
He's a little sloggier than Malcolm Gladwell. And I don't particularly love. I'm kind of like, oh, how nice that your data that you selected lined up so appropriately for
you.
Yeah,
a little pat. Yeah.
Pack me some more insights, Malcolm.
He writes in an essay he wrote for The Guardian, if humans are hackable animals, and if our choices and opinions don't reflect our free will, what should the point of politics be? How do you live when you realize that your heart might be a government agent, that your amygdala might be working for Putin, that the next thought that emerges in your mind might well be the result of some algorithm that knows you better than you know yourselves?
Well, in some ways, that last bit is probably true. However, the rest, I'm kind of like, way to use your dramatic license, buddy.
See, he's trying to make it less of a slog for you.
Okay, I read AI research
papers.
Yeah, that's sloggy. I'll slog if I think it's worth it.
Read the DeepMind paper.
But I'm not going to slog for that anyway.
And then this article from the deputy governor of the Central Bank of Sweden. Why Sweden's cashless society is no longer a utopia. He points out that when people use private businesses to exchange value, as they have apparently in Sweden, the outstanding value of cash in circulation in Sweden is 1%, about a tenth of other developed nations, because no one has cash. And furthermore, they mostly use an app called Swish.
Mm-hmm.
And
that is true.
Yeah. And so as a result, he says, this is problematic for governments. This development raises some crucial issues regarding the state's role in the payment market. For hundreds of years, the public has been offered central bank notes and coins. If cash stops working, it would leave all individuals to rely on the private sector alone to get access to money and payment methods. This would be a historical change without precedent.
This is actually, so I actually read about this a couple of years ago. It was brought up in relation to Sweden, actually. And there's going to be a regulating body. Either we'll have a crisis that's precipitated because of this. So like somebody will go out of business or somebody will hack the, you know, private intermediary and change the value of money in a way that people are like, holy cow. So we're going to have either a reckoning or we're going to prevent the reckoning by recognizing that it's coming and build up some sort of governmental body to manage that.
It is interesting because really, in most cases, the way you deal with money is all through private institutions, a bank, apps, whatever. But the money, the fundamental money you're dealing with is printed by the government and backed by the government.
Right.
What if the government had no role in this at all? What would that look like?
Well, it looks like, you know what?
What?
Well, that also looks like...
What? Don't leave me hanging. What?
Bitcoin.
Oh, Bitcoin. Well, that's, I think, probably the point. In fact, this guy's solution is to have an e-currency that's from the federal government. He wants to call them e-krona. But I don't see that that's any different than any other
fiat. What's the difference
fiat?
Between e-krona and krona? Because it's all imaginary.
It's a fiat currency. Fiat currency. So... you still have to pay your taxes.
Well, yes, but
so you still have to exchange your, you know, virtual non-governmental currency for governmental currency at some point.
Well, what the fear isn't that it the fear is that if something happens in this case that the currency suddenly you've got worthless currency basically because there's this private company. So yes, I mean, you still pay the government in something that is converted back to krona, whatever.
Right. Are you going to Stockholm tomorrow night?
Ask them, will you?
you can't actually, this was really sad. When I was in Sweden, I could not download Swish. I was so excited to try it. But my credit cards are all tied to the US. So they were like, nope,
you have to be one of the Swedish credit.
There are four banks, I think, that back Swish in that. So if your bank doesn't participate in the Swish banking
network.
But
imagine in this country, if everything you did, you had to either use Apple Pay or Android Pay or Samsung Pay.
Well, okay, but Swish is actually created by the banks. So the app was created by the banks who didn't want to get disintermediated by those things.
Right.
So we have that here too. Different.
It's called Zelle and it's horrible.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to use it.
Swish is not as bad, apparently.
Yeah. Everybody uses Venmo or Cash.me, which is from Square. Venmo's from PayPal. I mean, really, we're moving in that direction into a cashless society that's entirely exchanging.
Well, and Sweden is very cashless. Like, you can't, like, there's no place to use cash.
You can actually put up a sign in your store that says cash not accepted here.
There's tons of places that don't accept cash.
Right. There are tons the thing that's taken over New York, every city in America is the same, but it's just right around me. There's like 25 places where the food comes in bowls. Like we've lost the ability to use plates.
Pretty soon you won't get utensils either.
Got to take everything. Yeah, just slurp it up. Plates are too flat. Bowls are protective, right? So every one of the, you know, a lot of those places, a couple of those places, I go up and I try to give them a $20 bill. Oh, sorry, sir. No, we don't take cash. Like, you fool, you idiot.
Why would you
How
do
long
that?
Have you been asleep?
We've worked so hard to protect you with our bowls and you try to use this dirty piece of paper?
Yes.
Shame on you.
Well, it's beneficial to a vendor, like a company, especially a small one, because they don't have to worry so much about like embezzlement and things like that.
They pay 3% of every transaction.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's worth it to them to deal with, like, to eliminate the register person and all of this other thing.
This is like the thing now is everything comes in bowls. Did Chipotle start that?
A while. Plus the salad places.
Yeah, I think it's kind of a fix of the salad and grain places that just dump all this stuff in there,
true?
Like the Buddha bowls.
Are we bowl focused here in Petaluma? I think we still use plates.
No, it's bowls here. You're behind a couple
good
years.
Salad
bowls.
Places here.
Even the salad places are on plates. Or no, they're in those plastic boxes.
Styrofoam?
We do a lot of boxes. No, clear plastic or paper if they're hip. They're boxes. We're back in the box era still.
Now we're bold here. And man, you can get everything in bowls, right? And you go to there's the places. I hate Beets. I can't stand Beets. I just can't abide them. But there's a restaurant named something like the Beet. I'm not going in there.
The Beet.
I'm not doing it.
How about the Beet Bowl? Let's all go to the Beet Bowl. Come on, Jeff. We're coming to New York. Bowls. I'm buying Beet Bowl for everyone.
And you're gonna. I think I'll have a little kale and some edamame and some beets and some Brussels sprouts too.
Jeff, we're too old for this world. I knew this would happen someday. I just didn't think it would happen today.
I had my poke today. Poke in the bowl.
Poke bowl.
Okay, poke bowls are a thing. That's like how you serve someone.
Of course, it's New York. Everything that's a thing is a thing here.
Well,
it starts in New York, and I don't mean Long Island City.
It started in Hawaii.
That's where they're from, not Japan. Poke bowls are from Hawaii.
Hawaii.
We got Mexican bowls. We got salad bowls. We got barbecue bowls. We have poke bowls.
It is kind of the infantilization of food.
It is.
Do you get sippy cups with your bowls?
Oh, this is very important, too. Did you see the trailer for the new Toy Story?
No.
Oh, no, I missed it.
There's a new character. And I think there's a controversy here.
Bowl man?
Well, they don't call it that. You ruined the punchline. Thank you very much, Stacey.
I'm sorry.
Stacy. Put her back on mute, will you?
This is Toy Story 4, right?
They call the character Forky, which you're about to see.
All right, watch this. Watch this. From Disney, the people who gave you Walt.
Flows and flows of angel.
Hope you don't get pulled from YouTube for this song.
Is that Judy Collins? I'm going to get taken down because of the Judy Collins song.
You can put it on.
It's not adding anything to the overall.
No,
so you see all Buzz and
all happy in the sky.
Cowgirl and Mr. Potato Head. The cowboy. I don't even know their names. Then the dinosaur. Used to be Don Rickles, right? But he's passed away. The pig. The little pig, little rubber. There's the alien with the three eyes.
Yeah. Yeah. After the dog.
And it says, next summer, you can turn the sound up. Next summer,
there's a. I don't belong here!
Now they call the character Forky, but it's not a fork.
It's a spork.
So it should be called Sporky.
Sporky's a better name.
It is. I'm having a fit.
I'm not a toy!
Yeah, he's got pipe cleaner hands. I don't even get it.
He doesn't identify as a toy? People misidentify him as a fork?
Yeah. Okay, Kevin, who is an expert on juvenilia here, has come in to explain.
There's another teaser trailer.
It's a Key and Peele teaser trailer for this? They're voicing Key and Peele are part of the toy collection. How exciting. Here's some serious news, and I'm really happy. Just in case you're thinking of swatting anybody, this guy, Tyler Barris, pleaded guilty on Tuesday to making a SWAT call. He made many, but one that actually caused the death of an innocent Kansas man. It was a dispute between two online gamers over a $1.50 bet in a Call of Duty video game. He pled guilty. He'll be going to jail for between 20 and 25 years. 51 charges, including federal charges, initially filed in California in the District of Columbia related to other fake calls and threats. He's going to jail, folks, for 25 years.
Phone is a deadly weapon.
That is not okay. Not okay. He'll be sentenced in January. We'll find out. Also charged as co-conspirators, an 18-year-old from Ohio and a 20-year-old from Kansas. They've pled not guilty. Their trial's coming up in January. We reported on this when it happened. A police officer responding to the phony SWAT call, fatally shot, went to a house that wasn't the right house and fatally shot a 20-year-old man. Okay, I didn't mean to bring you down from Sporky and all that stuff, but I think was time to get serious. So let's take a break, and when we come back, your picks of the week, because we're almost done.
Okay.
Woo-hoo! I'm sorry. I should not
be so happy, Higginbotham.
I'm so hungry, and my husband just was like, hey, we're going to go out tonight because there's no water in our neighborhood. So I was like, queso!
Still no water in your...
Okay, this is just right now.
Okay.
This is not still leftover.
This is not leftover from boiling the water in Austin.
But basically, I'm excited because I'm getting queso.
Tell him, shut down.
At the end of this.
Andrew! I'm coming for queso!
You got to have queso like every night before you go to Seattle. You got to last chance for queso.
I am very concerned about the queso situation.
Oh, you can imagine. They're going to put kale in it up there.
I didn't know queso existed till I went to Austin a few years ago. Here I am, a grown man, a gourmet, a man of the world. I thought I knew everything. And then I went to Austin and they served me up this delicious, warm, cheesy substance. My life changed. Do you know why queso is so good?
Because it's melted cheese. Oh, because it has opiate.
Casein. It's an opiate.
Yes.
We now know that there's an ingredient in cheese called casein that apparently attaches to the same brain
receptors
as opiates. Casein is actually dairy cheese, particularly. Contains casein, also contains casein fragments called, get this, casomorphins, a morphine
like. It's pronounced casomorphines.
Oh my God.
Thank you, Carsten.
A casomorphin. It's a morphine like compound, opiate molecules. There's a reason.
So basically, I'm high all the time. I like it.
Well, not when you move to Seattle. You're going to be depressed all the time. It's always raining.
Oh, they have other cheese up there.
They do.
You're trading in queso for coffee.
That's got its own special buzz.
What's happening?
One substance for another. Why not?
Why not? Our show today is quite literally brought to you by CashFly. CashFly is our content distribution network. When you download a show, whether your podcast app downloads it or you go to our website and download it, you're connecting directly to CashFly. And I'll tell you what, we've been on CashFly practically since the beginning, and I have not once received that 3 a.m. phone call. Oh, the content distribution, the CDN is down. No, if you're in podcasting, if you're in software, and you're in any business that relies on having your content available readily at any time to your consumers, you need a CDN, but here's the problem for a lot of us with CDNs. You can't always predict your bandwidth consumption. Twit's very spiky. We don't know from one day to the next how much bandwidth we're going to use. Fortunately, CashFly makes it easy. They eliminate CDN outages. They help you reach new markets because they have servers all over the world. So no matter where our listeners are, they download it just as fast. And you control costs with CashFly. I love the CashFly team. Easy to talk to, smart, agile techs. They can answer your questions the first time. They won't put you on hold. They won't fend you off to somebody else. They're really good because CashFly empowers them. 100% availability with their bulletproof 100% SLA. That's right. I said 100%. So you don't get angry emails or hundreds of letters from users because the CDN's down and you don't get that 3 a.m. phone call. I could tell you, we deliver petabytes of data every month without a hiccup ever, thanks to CashFly. And I don't worry about costs. I don't log in multiple times a week or try to track my CDN usage because CashFly will tailor the plan to your yearly usage trends. So those spikes, they get all smoothed out. In fact, we save a lot of money. On average, customers who switch to CashFly save more than 20%. 20%. Here's what Ars Technica says. We use it, but Ars Technica says, CashFly has exceeded our expectations on every level, from the technical operation to the actual service to the top-notch support staff and their responsiveness. We literally would not exist if it weren't for CashFly. Let Cashfly give you some sanity back, too. And we have a new deal just for Twit listeners. Up to $2,000 in credits when you switch to Cashfly before the end of the year. Learn more and get a complimentary quote at twit.cashfly.com. Up to $2,000 in credits. Rates are based off 30% off MRC. Bill credit applied for a 12-month period. And again, don't wait. This exclusive offer is available only until January 1st. I want you all to check it out. twit.cashfly.com. If you deliver content, you know, this was a big threat. When we first started Twit, we were seeding BitTorrent seeds for listeners. They would become our, quick, can you put this? And it was crazy. Thank God. Cashfly, Matt Levine and his team came over and said, we can help. And they have for almost a decade now. Twit.cashfly.com. Thank you, Cashfly. Bless you. Stacy, you have a pick of the week this week?
I do. This is a fun one for anybody who's in the Amazon Echo ecosystem. So someone had asked us, and we talked about it on the podcast. So if you listen to both of us, you've already heard this and you can feel superior to everyone else. Mm-hmm. This is a skill called Notify Me on the Echo. And so the links I put in here are for the skill itself and then an article that Kevin wrote on how to use this. It's a little bit more involved, but what it does is you can take any device in your house. We did it with Ift, so that talks to Ift, and we basically made it so Amazon's, when a motion was triggered by my Wyze camera, my Echo would turn yellow, and it would, if I asked it to play my notifications, I would get the notification. I would say, hey, play my notifications, and it would say, your Wyze cam saw movement. So it's a little, it's less useful than it automatically going, bing, Stacy, I saw movement. But that also might get annoying. So I understand why they did it this way. And it was just kind of a fun thing to do. You could use it for anything that's on Ift. So I actually thought it might be kind of cool if you were waiting for a certain email. You could get, you type that in for your email thing. So if I get an email from this person, notify me on Echo would be kind of the recipe, what it looks like. And then if that email comes in, your Echo turns yellow and it's like, hey, so-and-so sent you the email.
Nice.
So have fun with this. It was actually kind of, I thought this was fun and it's actually somewhat useful. So
awesome. And where should we go to read about this? Your blog?
Yes, there's a link on Stacy on IoT, how to trigger custom Madam A notifications. And I bet in the chat room, Scooter X has already found it. Has he?
Yes, he has.
Oh, I was like, oh, he's moving slowly.
No, it's already scrolled off the page. Absolutely.
There we go. That's how fast he is.
That's how fast he is. Stacy on IoT.com. That's actually a good place to sign up for the newsletter and the podcast, too.
It is true.
Jeff Jarvis, a number?
Stacy sets such a high bar. Somewhat useful. It's a very high bar. Let's see if I can match that one. I don't know. It may be tough because I'm pretty much useless. There's two here. One is that people have raised more than $1 billion on Facebook since 2015 in their charities. And there's other Facebook news today, which we didn't get to, but let's put that aside.
I feel guilty because we talked about it before the show, and then I realized I didn't get to it in the show. It isn't really news. It's one of those great Times pieces about, you know, how behind the scenes at Facebook. It's good.
The worst of it is they hired a conservative company, and they were trying to tie people who were criticizing Facebook with George Soros. Not a good thing.
He's to blame.
But the rest of it's mainly just a TikTok and the personalities and the actions and what went on. So anyway, you can read that news in the New York Times today about Facebook. But also on the good news side, and full disclosure, of course, I raise money for the Craig Newmark Graduate School of Journalism from Facebook, but I am independent of them and none of it goes into my pocket. All right. That is disclosure. So $1 billion. And so on Giving Tuesday, Facebook will match a total of up to $7 million.
Wow.
Facebook and PayPal will match donations of up to $250,000 per nonprofit and up to $20,000 per donor, which is kind of cool when you think about it. If you get all your friends to give $250,000, you can turn that into $500,000 if you get in time and quickly. It's a little gamification. And then
you should do your disclosure.
I did it so fast you couldn't hear it.
You didn't hear his disclosure? It was awesome.
I was thinking about queso. I'm sorry, Jeff.
your endorphins were blocked. The other one is the Pixelbook is going to be $699 at Best Buy for Black Friday.
Awesome.
That is awesome. Leo, do you have something? Because if you don't, I have a great story that everyone should read because it was awesome.
I will just quickly say this and I'll throw it to you. And I don't know who put this link in the show notes, but I did want to make sure you saw it. It's from the Mozilla Foundation. It is a list of...
Yes!
It's just right for people who are about to buy, say, oh, I don't know, a Facebook portal. It is devices that you might not want to buy this holiday season.
Or that I might happen to want to buy.
Or that Jeff might love.
Because I want to live dangerously.
I can't tell you how many of these I own and use every day.
Me too. Well, and if you, I will say it's nice if you dig in on them. They explain
why,
what makes them bad.
Right.
Which, like for the Anova sous vide, one of the issues is encryption.
Right.
Do you care if your sous vide cooker does that? I don't know.
It's good. Here's the bike that I ride, to stay in shape, the Peloton bike. And why is it creepy? Well, you know, because I don't know, company, I don't know. You actually can weigh in too. How creepy you think this is. You can vote. Here, I'm going to vote.
There's a scale on here that says...
I don't think it's creepy, but I guess I'm all alone because according to voters... anyway, this... So what is the creepiest thing? I think it's the Facebook portal. It's not even on here yet.
Wait, what about the Parker teddy bear?
Oh, there's a good one. Is that
no,
listening in on
it's actually not that creepy.
It's a classic teddy bear, no built-in Wi-Fi or Bluetooth, no batteries, but there is an app. And when you point the app to his tummy, it starts to play.
The only reason it's a problem is because its privacy policy is written for people who it's a difficult to understand privacy policy.
Right.
That is really the only reason it's on here, which is why I'm kind of like, Mozilla, I love you, but.
So it's things that are
panic, perhaps
from a little creepy to somewhat creepy to good Lord, you don't want that in your house.
The Wyze Cam, which we all know and love, it's on here because its privacy level is difficult. So it's grade 13 privacy. It's EULA, basically. But it also shares your information with third parties for unexpected reasons. Dun, dun, dun. And I have read the Wyze Cam privacy policy, and I do not actually... I've read them, and I don't recall that in there. So now I've got to go back, and I'm like, really, Melissa?
This is for the tin foil hat crowd.
Well, I don't know. I mean, in a grade 13 privacy policy, it's possible I missed it.
Yeah.
Because, you know...
Yeah. Yeah.
A little techno panic going on. Yeah, I'm saying.
Like I said, I have pretty much all of this stuff. So,
yeah. I'm like, I have 9 out of 10 of those devices in my home right now.
Yeah. It has toys, it has smart home, it has entertainment, wearables, health and exercise. It's pretty much everything that phones home. And some things that don't, like that teddy bear. Ladies and gentlemen, was that the story you wanted to bring up?
No, my story is The Verge's story on the kilogram being dead. Long live the
kilogram.
Wasn't
that fascinating?
That's just, everyone should go read it because it's awesome.
So until,
that is all.
Actually, today, the term kilogram is defined by an actual piece of metal in a triple sealed vacuum dome in Paris. But there's a problem. Every time they bring it out to weigh it, which is like every 10 years, it's a little bit less. It's the last physical object that defines these key measurements. Like the meter is now defined by how long it takes light to travel a certain amount of time. This is the last one that's actually physical, and they're going to change it to a based on physics instead of an actual thing.
That is very cool.
And it gives the history of why we have
really
the metric
good.
System. It's a really great article. And I feel like, you know, you guys who listen to the show are probably like the type of people who would be like, yeah, this is awesome.
Well, and interestingly, even in the U.S. where we don't use kilos, we still use this measurement.
Because physics. Because science.
Because it's, you know, because science. Right. Because there are people who do use the metric system in the U.S. Strange.
All the right-thinking people of the world.
Strange that it may be. Come on, Stacey. You don't, when you hear the weather, you don't say, well, what is that in Celsius?
No, but I do. I would be a proponent of moving to the metric system. I really would.
Any sensible person would be.
See.
It ain't going to happen.
I know. All right.
Wouldn't that be funny if, how would you guys react if, like, President Trump said, you know, we're going to move to the metric system, and everybody moved, and it was like, that was his, that, like, would you change your tune?
You know, so he actually talked about reducing the number of guns out there. And I was like, you know what? That actually might be his Nixon in China kind of moment for me. I'd be like, okay.
He's just crazy enough that, you know, he could propose anything. You don't know. He could end daylight saving time.
With a stroke of a pen. I mean, that'd be nice. But
Right. I'd have to change my tune. Ladies and gentlemen, I just do that to rile Jeff. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes this portion of the program. You may now go consume queso morphines. Stacey Higginbotham. She is at StaceyOnIoT.com, at Giga Stacey on Twitter. Jeff Jarvis, professor, the Leonard Tao professor of journalistic innovation at the Craig Newmark Graduate School of Journalism at the City University of New York. And he's at BuzzMachine.com, the author of many fine. Are you working on a new book? You said you were, I thought.
I think we're thinking Gutenberg.
Nice. Like a bio?
The End of the Age.
Oh, I would read that.
First, I got to write it.
Get cracking, Jeff.
Get cracking.
I'm doing my research test. Do I have a book with me now? Oh, yeah, no. I've been reading lots of stuff.
It must be a good life being a professor. What do you think? I mean, my dad's a professor. I grew up my whole life in academia. I know what you mean, Jeff. I know what the ugh means. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. We do This Week in Google every Wednesday, 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 21:30 now. UTC, if you want to come by and say hi, please do. We'll break out the kilogram scale for you. You can watch at twit.tv/live. You can listen there, too. You can also chat at irc.twit.tv with all the other people listening and watching live. On-demand versions available at twit.tv/twig, or use your favorite podcast application and subscribe. That way you'll have the latest version the minute it's available. Have a wonderful, wonderful evening. And I'll be back here on Saturday. Actually, you might want to tune in for Triangulation this Friday. Kyle Weens of iFixit will join us to talk about the status of the right to repair movement. It took a big setback recently from Apple.
Wait, what? Oh, I thought we just had a big excitement.
You got to listen. Yes, and Kyle was very involved in that. Kyle was very involved in that. He'll be talking about the Apple T2 chip, which Apple has admitted will be used to break your machine if you dare to use third-party repair. In some cases. That's Friday, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, 2300 UTC. Thank you, everybody. We'll see you next time on This Week in Google. Bye-bye.